First of all, can you hear me with the microphone? Yeah. Magic, okay. Right, Linda asked me to talk about these three orders under some sort of mistaken apprehension that I knew anything at all about Embryoptera and Zoroptera. Richard Thompson said to me earlier today, well, you probably know a little more than the rest of us, or something. So hopefully I'll know a little bit more. As you can see, we've got three orders here with a hugely divergent amount of morphology between them. Wildly different animals. Embryoptera, the web spinners. Zoroptera, rather charmingly, have the common name of angel insects. And Theraptera, of course, lice, which are my particular favourites. Neuroptera, they're all part of the Neuroptera, which is a rather sort of vague group. This is one of the least resolved cladograms I think I've ever seen. Obviously, somebody's made a valiant attempt right up at the top of it. And the lysin factor, let's see if we can make this work, the lysin factor sitting up there. But Zoroptera there, and can't even see, oh, there's the web spinners next to them. There are more resolved cladograms around, but they're all rather contentious. As I said there is some disagreement on phylogenetic resolution. I'm going to start at the end with the Zeds, the Zoroptera. Now, the name of Zoroptera means purely wingless. Well, I assume that's where we get angel insects from the purity. It's one of the most recent orders described. And the name, in addition to meaning purely wingless, is also a good monument to extraordinarily poor sample size. and a really good warning for not naming something after a perceived taxonomic character. There aren't very many known at the moment. There are only about 33 species known, and they're all pretty small animals. These, I'm very much afraid, are about the best photographs I could find for you, so really absorb what you can see there, because that's about the level of it. You find Zoroptera around the tropics and subtropics. Most of the ones, or almost most of the ones, nearly half, I said, less than most of the ones known, hey, are from Central South America. And that's where the big concentration is of known species. Other ones are dotted around over the tropics, almost everywhere, except Australia itself. They've got as far as Christmas Island, but none have yet been found in Australia. Well, you do find them. You tend to find them in quite large numbers. They're gregarious. They don't seem to be social insects, but you do find them together. They're probably closely related to either the Socodea, which is what I wrote when I did a thesis on lice some years ago, or the Blattoids. And in fact, looking at the wing structure of them, there was a paper a few years ago which presented quite compelling evidence that they were around about the mantid cockroach earwig end of things. That same paper moved the number of genera up from 1 to 7, based entirely on wing venation. Which, as far as the raptor ever excited anybody, excited quite a few people then, because it seemed to be a tremendous increase in numbers based on only one character set. For any of those of you who are wing freaks, there are some raptor wings for you. These are three different genera, forewing, hindwing. So that's one genus, that's another genus, and those are all Eusazoros. I bet you can't guess where that one comes from. As I said, originally, Zoroptera were thought to be wingless. And then gradually, winged forms came up. You can get hold of winged forms in two ways. Either by collecting a colony of Zoroptera and putting them in a jam jar and seeing what happens, and you can rear up winged individuals. Or by flight intercept traps. They've been caught reasonably often in flight intercept traps around the world. And quite possibly, if we took a look at our flight intercept trap catches, particularly from where we've done quite a lot, like Sulawesi, we might well find some. The only problem is that the wings themselves are extremely delicate and they'll break off, leaving rather small stubs very, very easily. What seems to be the case is that for any one species, there are two forms. There's a winged form and a wingless form. And as you quite often find where that's the case, the winged form can be darkly pigmented. It'll have quite large eyes. It'll have a ocelli. The wingless forms are rather pale, wishy-washy looking insects. They don't have eyes, they don't have a ocelli. And that, as I say, is not uncommon within the Neoptera, where you get that to form. Both of the sexes can have wings, both males and females. Though the males with wings are extremely rare, generally females that you find with wings. Now, if you look at a colony of Zoroptera, you'll find that males and females are there 50-50 in wingless forms. So there doesn't seem to be a sexual imbalance between males and females generally. What appears, well, what is possibly happening is that the female's the dispersive phase. So the females are mating and then leaving the colony to go and found another one. And then dropping the wings when they got there. Zoroptera are actually quite interesting in terms of their male-female interactions. There's only one study being done on two species which are actually totally sympatric. You can find the two living side by side. In one species, the whole reproductive element is completely male-controlled. The males will fight for dominance amongst themselves to access females. And the whole range of different activities. They start off by head-to-head contact and just vibrating their antennae at one another. If that doesn't work, they'll do a bit of butting, you know, like goats or something like that. If that doesn't work, they'll turn their backs on one another, as you see here, and start flicking their legs at one another. And after a while, if it's really heavy stuff, they'll grapple with their hind legs and start fighting. And as the paper said, in extreme cases, some damage can be caused, like loss of legs and loss of head. minor damage. And then the dominant male will then maybe even keep a harem of females. Another thing that was written in one of the papers on this is that the male is in entire charge of copulation and maintains his hold on the female by inserting as much as possible of the intermittent organ, which depends on your viewpoint, but sounds rather nasty. The alternative, another species found in the same place, is entirely female-controlled. Now, in this case, the male, in order to get access to a female, offers her a gift. He's got a special gland on the back of his head. Will bend forward. The female will take the fluid from this gland. And apparently, the fluid is valuable in some way in terms of egg production. And the female, not unreasonably, I suspect, and in quite human fashion, will select the male on the quality of the gift. The female may mate two or three times, either with the same male or a variety of males. And in this case, the female is in entire control of the copulatory process. And at any point, can halt it. I was tempted to say break it off, but that's going beyond my knowledge in this particular case. Anyway, the female is in entire control. So two very different strategies of two closely related insects living in the same place, which is kind of bizarre, and I really would wish I could go further with that, but unfortunately nobody at the moment can. The female Zoroptera only produces 8 to 12 eggs in her life, so it's not a rapid increase, it's not a huge number of eggs produced. Mating takes place end to end, and the paper said sometimes with a male on his back and can last for an hour. And some species apparently are facultative parthenogenetic, which doesn't surprise me, speaking as a male. The idea of being dragged around on the back of my head for an hour doesn't really fill me with excitement. So there we are. That basically is what I can tell you about Zoroptera. The feeding. I really ought to tell you what they feed on. You usually find them under dead bark, with rotting wood, piles of old sawdust, somewhere where the environment's vegetable, basically, and have been around for quite some time. They are, however, omnivorous. They'll feed on pretty well anything. Fungal spores and hyphae, they'll feed on dead arthropods. They'll even go out and be predaceous and catch mites, nematodes, calendula, and feed on them. And if they're crowded in the colony, they can actually become cannibals, which is presumably another reason why the females shift off to form new colonies whenever they need to. They're sometimes found in termite nests, and sometimes found in mammal nests. In the termites, it's been suggested they're feeding on the fungal gardens of the termites, but that's just supposition. The Zoroptera are extremely small. We still, despite all that entertainment about their reproductive systems, know remarkably little about them. For the last word, I must give you this. which I picked off a website, Zoraptera do not have any economic significance. They are rarely collected, which I think is a kind of sad. Okay, Embryoptera. Now this one, the name means lively wings. And I do apologise, having got you that name, to illustrate it with a specimen which has no wings at all. I'm afraid this wing business was a bit of a problem when I was constructing the talk. Web spinners or foot spinners are the common names. And as John mentioned before some of you arrived, this is because they're very much associated with webs. A bit more about that in a moment. There are around 200 species, and someone suggested there may be around 2,000 in the world. To what extent that was a wild guess and to what extent that was a real estimate is difficult to tell. And they live in silken tunnels. There we are, there's some silken Zoraptera tunnels, Embryoptera tunnels. There's one of the Embryoptera. There's another one just leaving the picture up there. This was under a stone in Turkey, I believe. The insects are producing silk the entire time, as larvae and as adults, the whole life stage, which is itself quite unusual. In the tropics, in humid regions, these silken tunnels are quite often exposed. You'll find them on tree trunks or diving into crevices of bark. Otherwise, they may be in cracks in the ground, in cracks in tree trunks, in soil, under rocks, in leaf litter, or indeed in termite nests, pretty well anywhere where you're getting somewhere fairly obscure. As I say, they're still spinning silk the entire time. The glands are on the front legs here. Here's the tarsus, tarsus there. It's packed with these silk-forming glands. And each gland has a ceta sticking above it. And as the ceta brushes the side of the silken tunnel, so silk is automatically ejected. So the thing is, it can't help but spin more silk. Moreover, as it goes through its tunnels, it spins round and round, so it's always rotating. More and more silk is being produced as it does so. The function of the tunnels appears to be protection against predation, at least in part. You sometimes find ants sitting around the outside, trying to get in at the food and failing miserably. It's also quite good to retain humidity, particularly in dry areas, obviously. And sometimes the silk will be covered in bits of dirt or whatever, but mostly it's sort of nice bluish grey, at least to start with. And you can see here, there's quite those large tarsi there, which are producing the silk. The animals can move backwards and forwards within the galleries very easily. They've got quite strong back legs and can push themselves backwards. Again, a way of getting away from predation. To the flight. The females, that's a female, all lack wings. Whereas the males have wings. Straightforward enough. I mean, there you see the nice front tarsi. And they're the heavy back legs for moving backwards. As I say, they can move backwards through the tunnels very easily to escape predation. You might think the wings are a bit of a bad plan if you're going to be shifting backwards through a narrow tunnel. And indeed they are. What the male does with its wings, if it's moving backwards fast in a tunnel, what it apparently can do is fold its wings forward over its head. So, I tell you, this is true. As it moves backwards, the wings, they're very floppy, and they'll just fall backwards over the head, as it were, as the animal moves backwards, and can just sort of move like rubber to and fro. When the thing flies, it pumps blood into the wings, and the wings become rigid, and then it can fly. This is it's just something it can sort of switch on and off. The reason, in this case, it's thought why the males have wings and the females don't is actually the reverse from the Zoraptera condition. It appears that the males are the dispersal phase and the females not. So the males will leave a colony, and again, they're quite colonial animals, quite rapidly after it's emerged. It has to do everything quite fast because it doesn't feed. It's got quite large jaws, but what it uses those for is to clasp the female around the head during copulation. So it'll fly to find a female somewhere else. It will clasp around the head to copulate. It will release its clasp from the female's head, and it will then very sadly get eaten, because the females do the mantis thing, and feed on the males, eat the males after copulation. So basically what you've got is the female spending quite a lot of time in galleries, the males just being dispersal and living very shortly, which is why the males can still afford to have wings and the females tend not to, perhaps. The females themselves, let's see, after they've mated, the females will then spin a little gallery, a little chamber off the main gallery, to lay the eggs in, and the eggs are laid on the silk. They're sometimes covered in a mass of leaf litter or frass or some muck. But the female quite often will guard the eggs. And then when the nymphs hatch out, she'll guard the nymphs for a short while as well. The colonies will be quite large, a number of different ages, stages, nymphal stages, adult stages there. But again, there can be cannibalism. So the nymphs spin their little little tunnels as fast as they can, and because they're little tunnels, the adults can't get in there. And they're protected not against external predation, but also against the adult predation as well. The galleries themselves, as well as being to protect the things against predation, also they go between food sources. The things appear to be herbivorous. They're feeding on dead and live plants, bits of leaf litter, some live moss, some live lichens. Again, not a huge amount is known about these things. And now we get to my particularly favourite, lovely, lovable animals, the lice. And the name, rather unsurprisingly, means wingless lice, or lousy and wingless, which is where we got the pure lively and lousy from the title. Sorry. Chewing lice, biting lice, sucking lice, and a whole mass of other names, particularly given to the human lice. They're all obligate, permanent ectoparasites of mammals and birds. You don't find them anywhere else. They're all wingless, and they're found pretty well all over the world. Wherever you get a host living, you'll find lice on it. Not always the same lice, but lice. This chap is a pig louse, by the way. A little bit of classification there. We've got a whole mass of names for lice. As I said, the ordinal name now is Theraptera. Within that, you will sometimes see Molophaga as a name. And that's a paraphyletic group. And Anaplura, or Siphunculata, the sucking lice. The lice themselves appear to be an offshoot of the Cecoptera, the book lice. And the Cecoptera are paraphyletic themselves. The sister group of all the lice is the book lice themselves, the Lipocelidae. The little things that we occasionally find sitting around sinks in the department, feeding on fungus, feeding on little bits of mould. And actually, they're one of the reasons why we don't have plants in the department anymore, because they came into the and lived on the soil in the plants. And that's quite important when we come to think of the way lice evolved. Because one of the places you find Cecoptera is in bird and mammal nests, feeding on the detritus, feeding on the little bits of fungi there. And the Cecoptera you find there are wingless. And just like other Neoptera that lost their wings, they don't have ocelli. Just like lice, they don't have wings, they don't have ocelli. It appears the ancestor of all of the lice that already lost its wings, already lost a method of transport around the place. I'll come back to that. The Molophaga themselves, the lice themselves, I still use it, the Theraptera themselves, there are four suborders, as you saw on the tree there. The Amblycera, of which there are seven families, around 1,300 species. Amblycera and Ischnocera, another name for those two is bird lice, which, given that there are four families of Amblycera and two families of Ischnocera on mammals, again is one of these rather unfortunate common names that people give to things. Quite a large group. There are lots more than that, almost certainly. Any one species of a mammal or bird may have several species of louse living on it. And humans, for example. And we're terribly lucky. You know, we've got three all to ourselves. It's great. The largest number, I think, is one of the species of tinamous, almost flightless birds living in Central South America. They sort of flap around the forest floor. And one of those species has got 16 species of lice living on it. I think the maximum number of species from any one individual has been 12, which is really quite impressive. And the poor bloody thing must do nothing but peck itself to get rid of lice. Elephant lice, we've got one family and just three species now. And the sucking lice, 15 families and 500 odd species. Our lice, our human lice, are all sucking lice. And what do they feed on? Well, there we are. There's one of ours. It's a human body louse, happily feeding on somebody's hand. And it's feeding on blood. And all of the Anopura feed on blood. They'll plug in and suck. Also, some of the bird lice do. Some of the Amblystra are feeding on lice. Some of the Ischnostra and the other bird and mammal lice are also feeding on blood. Sorry, on blood. Some of them also feed on just sweat and oils of the skin. And you can see them getting in and just sucking away at the base of hairs. Some of them are feeding on bits of skin lying around on the body. And that's probably pretty ancestral. That's probably one of the reasons why the ancestral louse was living in a nest in the first place, to get the debris that was falling off the animal. Some of them are feeding on bits of feather. So you're just clipping away at the barbules. And there's one there I've got as other, because in the collection, in the department, I was going through looking at the gut contents of some of these, because on the slides you can see the gut contents. And on one monkey lice, I found what appeared to be a flea, just inside the gut. So the animal had somehow picked up a flea and eaten it, or a bit of flea. Now, whether that was carnivory, and I have this image of a louse stalking a flea through the hair of a monkey, or whether it was picking up a dead flea, I have no way of knowing. But it's conceivable these things are feeding on a variety of other bits and pieces, not just out of the host. How do they do it? Well, the sucking lice, here we are, this is the head of a human louse. This is just about to come down on the skin to plug in, okay? It's got two stylets right in there. And it sticks those in, just pierces the skin, injects an anticoagulant, and then just sucks, and the blood will come in. With the chewing lice, the ones with functional mandibles, they'll either just bite away at a bit of feather, as this thing's doing, or sometimes you'll find the mandibles are quite sharp. And in that case, like the dog louse, it'll pierce the skin and just lap up or suck up blood. But mostly it's either chewing like that or piercing and sucking. The hummingbirds have got two sorts of lice on them, both supposedly chewing lice. And in those, the mandibles have got adapted to be stylets just like the sucking lice. And again, they pierce and suck. A lot of what lice is about is how to live on an animal, how to live on their host. Because really, the host is pretty well the entire environment for these things. And one of the factors of the host, of course, is got hair or feathers to cling onto. So there we are, there's one of our crab lice with huge, great claws. They're not really red. This is a tinted photograph, just in case any of you rush off home to give yourself a personal inspection to look for things with red claws wandering over your hair. Very big, and they'll cling like there. That's a human head louse claw, just neatly enfolding the hair shaft. And there you see again, it's the claws around the hair shaft. For reasons which are pretty unclear, all mammal lice have one claw, and all bird lice have two claws. They both use the claws to hang on, but it's easier, obviously, for a mammal lice to have one and bird lice to have two. The mammal lice have evolved a single claw at least three times. No, at least four times. There are other ways of hanging on. One of the things I used to do when I collected lice for study here was to pick up roadkills. So whenever I was on holiday or just maybe driving into work, if I saw a recently dead host mammal generally lying by the side of the road or occasionally in the middle of the road, I'd stop the car, leap out, drag it up and shove it in the back. Because then you could get the really fresh lice and quite often they'd still be alive. It didn't go down terribly well with the family, I must say. There was one particular occasion where the badger I picked up on a family holiday wasn't quite as fresh as I thought it was. But hey. But I did on one occasion manage to bring in a badger to work and sat, I think it was the first floor at that point. For some reason they made me move off it quite soon afterwards. Sat with the badger sprawled out over the desk and a microscope mounted on top so I could see the lice doing their stuff. And this was really quite fun, you know, you could see the hair and all the lice sort of moving around and doing their bit. And what I saw was that when the lice weren't doing anything else, when they weren't sort of heavily engaged in looking for something to eat or sex or whatever, when they were just sitting and meditating, they do what this thing's done. It's closed its mandibles around a hair and then let go. So the only way that animal's actually holding onto the hair at the moment is through its mouth. And they just sit there, generally upside down, mandibles around the hair, legs sort of like that, just gently thinking, or whatever lice do. And they've got a number of little adaptations here. There's a great groove down the centre of the head, just to fit the hair. And it fits the hair pretty precisely. And as different mammals have different thicknesses of hair, that's probably one of the things that keeps them on the host they want to be on. And the other thing, the mandibles themselves, if you take the mandibles off and then look on the inside, you'll see just grooves like that. There, that's that mandible. Just the grooves that are the open, the face of the mandible touching the hair. And that's obviously an anchoring point, just to, so it's really anchored onto the hair and can't be moved off. The big problem for lice, or one of the big problems for lice, is grooming by the host. Running the claws or the tongue or the beak through the hair and just dragging them off. And that is really a pretty effective anchor. This one has done something rather different. This is a guinea pig louse, and the whole leg there has curved round. The inside of the leg is striated, and it clamps on around the hair like that. And again, it's a really effective anchor to hold on. So they're holding onto the hair in a number of different ways. And as I said, the whole deal is not to get knocked off. A louse that's fallen off the host is a dead louse. They need to be on the warmth of the host. If they're off there, if they're wandering around the ground, they're going to die in a few hours. If you, with the human lice, it's often said that, well, they're spread by, you know, backs of chairs or scarves or whatever. No, if they're off the head, they're dead. They're damaged and they can't get back on again. Okay. Reproduction. In this case, these things are a porcupine lice. And again, they've got their mouth parts sort of around the hair to hold on. That one's the male. And this rather endearing picture is to show how lice actually hug one another. They are quite romantic animals. And here we are, the male, he's got his antennae clasped lovingly around the female's waist there. And it's beautiful, isn't it? And you'll find quite a lot, seriously, you'll find quite a lot of them. The antennae of the males are really heavily adapted. They've got this huge basal segment. Probably only three segments, the female may have five. They might have great teeth at the end of the flagellum, all to hold on to the female. There are some species where the antennae of the male are considerably larger than the foreleg. There's a little tiny foreleg, rather sort of like a dinosaur's, but the antennae are huge and hulking just to hold on to the female. And of course the male has inserted the genitalia into the female genital chamber. I did spend quite a lot of time a few years ago looking at louse genitalia. I was even making models of louse genitalia. It was one of the sadder periods in my life, I must admit, but hey. This is a cutaway at the end of a louse abdomen. So the thick black lines are where I've cut away there, and that's the opening. These are the male genitalia. There's a pair of fused paramires there, and those are paramires, those are mesomeres. Doesn't matter. couple of sclerotized prongs, if you like. There's a thing like a tuning fork on top and a couple of prongs underneath. And there's the bit that actually everts inside the female. Now, the female in these things, you might think she doesn't actually want to be mated with at all. Because what she's got, if you look at the genital chamber, round the outside are a whole load of backward-pointed spines. And there's a little spiny flap over the opening to the chamber itself. And this is not good, because the male has got to get this rather sensitive, delicate bit inside the female. And if it just sort of pushes it in, it's going to burst, poor thing. So what it's going to do is to get in past all this defense and then get the internal sac to evert. And this one's rather clever. You see the membrane there is much shorter than the membrane there. The male is underneath the female, and as it pushes this whole mass out, the tuning fork, as it comes underneath the flap, the spiny flap covering the opening to the genital chamber of the female, it mechanically just pushes back like that. You know, as it's pushing out, it's come to the end of that bit of membrane, so it has to move back. It has to hinge back. Those nice big plates are covering the spines on the other side of the opening. So what it's done, it's got itself protection for the floppy bit by these two plates. It's hinged away the covering plate of the female, and then it can avert inside. It's really rather a nice piece of mechanics. I know it works, because I made one. There are other lice doing different things. As I said, it was a sad period of my life. The dog louse does something rather different. It's got a similar problem. And the male there has got genitalia rather like an artillery shell. It's really two paramirs like that. And again, it pushes this through all the defences of the female. And once it's through, they open out. And then the big internal sac everts. You know, surprise! Hey, it's me! Oh, God. The whole mechanism of louse genitalia is absolutely fabulous. What's also appalling is that the homologies are virtually impossible to find, because it seems that every genus is doing something a little bit different. And the sclerites are vastly different. And quite how this has come about, I don't know. But the genitalia of lice are extraordinarily variable, but mechanically fascinated. Eggs. Okay. Just like the rest of the life stages of lice, the eggs are on the host. They can't be anywhere else. They're going to be stuck to the host. So the eggs are cemented onto the feather or the hair of the host. In the mammals, certainly, they're right down near the body, because the baby lice like it warm. They can't actually hatch if it's too cold. This is actually kind of important for humanity. Those of you who've got kids will know that every now and again, you get a little letter back from school saying, there's a little bit of a louse problem in the class. What used to happen is the kids used to be thrown out of class. The teacher or the nurse, Nitty Nora the Louse Explorer, would see these bright white nits, the louse eggs, on the hair. And the kid would be summarily pulled out of class and sent home. A little bit behind the times, because what was being seen there were the hatched eggs. The egg, when it's fresh, as it were, before it's hatched, is sort of greyish-yellow colour and right down near the scalp. It hatches and turns bright, milky white, like a little pearl, sweet. And at that point, of course, it's growing out with the hair from the scalp. And hair is growing at about a centimetre a month. You see these things when they're about 2 to 2.5 centimetres out. So by the time the kid is hauled out of class and sent home, it's had lice for at least 2 months. So a rapid response may not be entirely appropriate at that point. The eggs themselves are quite fun. The cement at the bottom there is hygroscopic. It takes up water from the atmosphere and keeps the humidity up for the embryo inside. Lice are really quite keen on keeping the humidity up. Remembering, a number of them are feeding on keratin, bits of feather or hair. not a lot of water there, and in fact they've got a whole massive water condensation system within the head to take atmospheric water up, and it's extremely effective. But that, for the egg, is sucking up water. There's air coming through the cap at the top there. Some louse eggs are kind of bizarre. This is a chicken louse egg. I don't have a photograph, sadly, but it's got lots of little spines there, each one with an anchor on the end of it. I haven't the foggiest idea why. Not the slightest. But it's very, very pretty. Louse eggs, again, just like their genitalia, are hugely variable. There's a massive number of characters there, which are almost completely ignored. When it comes to the louse itself hatching, again, this is quite entertaining, though on a very microscopic scale. With the human lice, where it's been studied more than anything, and probably with other lice as well, it hatches by air pressure. The first thing it does is to push off the cap. And that leaves a little opening, which is slightly smaller than the diameter of a louse. A problem. So what the louse does is suck in air, pass it through the gut, and expel it discreetly at the other end, building up this huge air pressure inside the egg behind it. And what happens after a while is the inevitable, that it shoots out of the egg rather like a ping pong ball out of a little kid's pistol. And the thing sort of fires itself across the host body, only a sort of millimetre or so, but that's how it gets out. And then immediately starts feeding. Where do they live? Okay, I've just said that lice are on the body of the host. Well, fine. But they don't all live in the same place on the body. If you start really sampling across a body of a bird or mammal, you find different lice in different places. And here we are. These are bird lice. And those are body lice. And those are wing lice. Let's get that a bit clearer. There's a wing louse. That actually is a head louse. And the reason for that's quite simple. For a bird, it's really very easy to preen at the wing. The beak can get there very easily. So the lice, if they're going to live on the wing, have to be pretty fast moving. And they can move backwards and forwards, they can move sideways, and they can slide around hiding behind feather barbules. So the bird can't get at them. The bird has a much more difficult task getting to the back of its head. The beak just doesn't go there, how much it tries. So the lice there can be quite slow living, quite slow moving, and quite fat and round. So you get very, very different morphologies according to just where on the host the animal is trying to live. And people have moved the lice around to see what happens. And the head lice, if you move them onto the wing or the tail coverts, they just go very, very rapidly. Feather lice just sort of zip back to where they belonged on the wings, but the birds simply cannot get at them. Some lice do live in rather odd places. We're happy about, okay, feather lice living on the feathers, and generally mammal lice live, you know, around about on the body, behind the ears or around the inguinal region or whatever. This one, this is a seal louse. Now, seal lice, as you might imagine, have particular problems. Because every now and again, the host insists on diving into the water. So what the seal lice do is go up its nose. So the seal lice live quite happily up seals' noses. For a lot of seals which are at sea for a lot of the year, the lice just shut down operations. The metabolism goes right down. They don't try and breed or anything. They just sit there, grabbing a quick spiracle full of air every time the thing surfaces and breathes. It gets worse. The pelican louse does exactly what you'd expect, and it lives inside the pelican's bill. Just around there, and you can pull up. We've got a lovely sample up in the collection of a chunk of skin from a pelican's bill, and it is covered in these lice. They're feeding on blood. They're all plugged in. They can't lay their eggs there, because, of course, there are no feathers, which they've got to glue the eggs to. So what the pelican lice do, whenever they want to lay an egg, is they come out through the nasal cavity of the penguin, of the pelican, get onto the head, lay an egg or two, and zip back in again. They are charming, charming animals. One of the problems for a louse, of course, is moving between hosts, moving from one animal to another. As I said, they can't survive off the host for very long, if at all. So they actually have to move across when two host individuals are in contact. That obviously happens most often between individuals of the same species. Again, back to human lice. With humans, particularly for the head louse, the demography of the host is that they are found mostly on kids of 3 up till about 6, mostly on females. And the reason for that is very, very simple. If you watch any school playground, you'll see that the children touch their heads together quite a lot. And as they get older and older, and boys particularly, they stop touching heads. So the louse demography on human heads is dictated entirely by the way that humans interact. And this is really the only significant way they do it. I've had calls from public health asking me, you know, should they close down swimming pools? Should they remove all furniture? All sorts of stuff. But this is really what's happening. It is important, actually, to be quite careful when dealing with public health inquiries. I, quite a few years ago now, was a little over-enthusiastic. Because it occurred to several of us that eradication of head lice in the UK would be extremely simple. All we needed to do was to ensure, probably through television, that everybody in the country treated themselves with a louse lotion, anti-louse lotion, at the same time. Great, you know, you could destroy all head lice in the country. And we had this rather pleasant picture of the royal family sitting down watching Coronation Street and putting the louse stuff on. Anyway, I got a call from a small village in Devon where there was a school with a louse problem. And maybe it was an afternoon, I don't know, but I was expounding this theory to the guy on the other end. I got a letter later thanking me for this. And what I have a horrible feeling that the guy did was to effectively cordon off the village and insist on everybody in the village disinfect themselves all at once, which is, of course, totally illegal. I thought of changing my name. And so lice move to host when they're in contact, and that can either be, obviously in this case, social contact. There may be other cases. Obviously, a major one is copulation. A lot of lice would seem to use that opportunity to shift across. And there are other possibilities across host boundaries in prey-predator relationships, for example. There's also one other possibility. Occasionally you'll find hippobosid flies with lice clinging to them. And it's been suggested this forestry is another way of lice moving from host to host, just clinging onto the hippobosid until it gets to another animal. What the lice are doing when they move across is doing it totally automatically. They're not sitting there thinking, hey, you know, we're running out of hair here. This is really a shabby sort of animal. I want to move to another one. They're just moving when the temperature gradient's broken down between two organisms. They're kept in by temperature gradient. So if the temperature gradient breaks down with two animals touching, that's when they're moving across because the environment's just constant. That's why people with long hair are more secure from lice than people with short hair, because the temperature gradient takes much longer to break down if you've got long, thick hair. So, yeah, Jan's okay. Paul's got a serious problem there. there are some environmentally mediated transfers which seem quite likely to have taken place. One, not the one illustrated, is the domestic cat. I can do my mammals, that's not a cat, I got that. The cat louse, from all of our moggies in this country probably, is not the louse you'd expect. It's not related particularly closely to the louse that's found on the wildcat, or to the lion, or the jaguar, or the puma, or anything else, which are all closely related. It's actually very closely related to mongoose lice. And you find the same species on the domestic cat and on the mongoose Herpestes ichneumon. Herpestes, just like the cats, is domesticated as a pet in parts of Africa. And there have been documented cases with herpestes sitting in the same box as people's cats. And it seems very likely that the mongoose lice got across to the domestic cat quite early in domestication and has just spread through that entire population. Another one is one of the dog lice. In this country, we've only got one dog louse. If you move into the tropics, anywhere between 40 north, 40 south, you've got two species. And the other species, the tropical species, the sister group is on a wallaby in New Guinea. And it would appear that somehow it's got it from the wallaby and then spread right around the world on the dogs in the nice warm bits. Another one which I particularly like is the elephant louse. You will be aware of folklore, of observation, that people's pets tend to look very much like people themselves. You know, you'll see sort of an old lady with bouffant white hair walking along the street with a little dog with sort of bouffant white hair and that sort of stuff. So the elephant louse won't really come as a surprise to you. As I said early on, there are three species of elephant lice now. And as those of you who've been keeping up will know, there are now three species recognized of elephants. That's pretty neat. Except that, of course, what you're seeing there, that is the true elephant louse, and that's found on the Indian elephant and the African elephant. Whether it's found in the jungle elephant or not, I don't know. It lives behind the ears, and this plugs straight in. It's a blood feeder, and that's going through the rather thick skin. The sister species to that is found on the warthog. And almost certainly there's been a transfer across between pigs and elephants in somewhere like waterholes, where you find both at the same time. And the warthog, having quite thick skin, also is a good host for a louse with a big drill like that on it. Incidentally, the elephant louse, the ordinal name has changed now, but it once had the longest ordinal name in the animal kingdom, Rhynchotherinaptera. And this is something that's about 2.5-3 millimeters long. And it was suggested that a huge name like this was a bit grandiose, was just a small insect. Think about transfer. This is an animal which willingly gets between two mating elephants. Come on, it deserves some sort of recognition. This limitation of movement between host and host, which means that most host movements are inter-host movements are between members of the same species, is very important for louse evolution. Louse evolution takes place more rapidly. Genetic change is more rapid than that of the host. That's been demonstrated quite clearly now. Louse speciation can be faster than that of the hosts. And lice tend, unsurprisingly in those circumstances, to be found on single species of hosts. What's quite entertaining is to look at the relationship between host specificity and between the agility of the animals. What I've done here is taken a number of families of insects, parasites and vertebrates. Those are Theraptera, those are one family of lice, that's another family of lice, Nycteribids on bats, Polyctenids on bats, Streblids on bats, Oestrids, Hippobossids, Histricovillids, fleas, Glycinids. I scored each life stage as to whether it was independent of the host, dependent on the host locality, like it had to be in a nest, or totally dependent on the host. And the more independent, I gave it a larger score. And I then plotted that against the percentage strict host specificity within the family. And I got what was really quite a nice regression line. Host specificity can be explained to a large extent just by how independent the insect is, the parasite is, how much it can move between hosts, how much opportunity it has to get between hosts of different species. This brings me on to poetry. I did promise you a poem. It occurred to me, Robbie Burns' Ode to a Louse, but I thought eight stanzas in pseudo-Scottish accent probably would be not good for you and not good for me. So we've got this, which I am informed is the shortest poem in the English language. A poem having some structure and also meaningful content. Now, this poem conjures up a number of problems. Firstly, of course, where did he get them? And secondly, and probably more, well, secondly, because that's a scientific question, and a theological question, is that given that man is created in the image of God, it actually was used by theologians as evidence of a second creation, because it was such a problem. Let's think about where he got them, which is co-evolution. We got our lice from our ancestors, almost certainly. If you go looking at gorillas, you will find that gorillas have a crab louse, just like us. It's a different species, but very, very close. If you look at chimpanzees, you'll find that chimpanzees have a body louse, just like ours. Different species, but very, very close. It's rather alarming that howler monkeys in Central America also have a body louse, but this is one of the things that's explained by perhaps social interaction. But it would appear, think about it. It would appear that in both those cases, the louse has come to us from louse of shared ancestors with our closest relations. And one of the things that's been said about lice for many years is that the louse phylogeny mirrors that of the hosts. By knowing the louse phylogeny, you can know the host phylogeny, and vice versa. Rather sadly, both of those arguments have been used for the same assemblage, so we've had a completely circular argument in some places. This has been examined a number of times now. Just looking at these theoretical phylogenies, that's parasite, host, that's what I'm talking about, strict co-speciation, mirror image phylogenies. But if one speciates and the other doesn't, if some go extinct, if some just shift on to a totally different host, there's a whole mass of different ways of evolution which can give you rather different patterns, non-parallel phylogeny. This one is phylogenies of pocket gophers and their lice, and this is held up as an example of really good co-evolution. As you see, there is still some problems, some sorting errors, if you like. And in a number of studies now, what's been found is that something like a third of all speciation events of the lice can only be explained by a sorting event, by them changing hosts in an unexpected way, by them speciating at a different time from the host, or the host speciating at a different time from the lice. It's a generally good pattern. It's not as good as a number of people rather hoped it would be. What about what lice do to you? Well, okay, first of all, there's a direct response to the immune system. The lice, particularly the blood-feeding lice, they're injecting anticoagulant, and that gives you a result. For humans, certainly, if any of you have had lice, you'll know that after a little while, you start just itching. After a little while longer, if you build up to a huge carrying capacity of lice, then you start getting an immune reaction. You start getting aching joints, headaches, drowsiness. You feel lousy. In case of school kids, they start really failing on the educational front, and they go down in the class. If you feel their heads, they're full of those nasty little gritty nits, you know, hitting out of the nitty-gritty because these nitwits, aren't they? This is where it's all coming from. Lice also are vectors of disease. They've probably killed more people than guns and bullets ever have. Typhus, a huge killer. Trench fever was a huge killer in a number of wars. Just irritation can reduce fitness. Grooming damage. You see dogs scratching away at lice and removing their fur and start really damaging themselves. The time taken by birds in preening. If a bird is preening to try and get lice off its feathers, and believe me, they need to get lice off their feathers. That's some feathers there. That's all lice damage. If they're preening, they can't go feeding. If they're preening, they can't be on the lookout for predators. Being lousy in a bird is a really bad thing. That peacock is saying, I don't have lice. That's the entire function, it seems, of that sort of display. The reason why male birds have these huge displays, they're displaying their fitness, and their fitness is in terms of being resistant to parasites, and therefore not passing on genes which are going to cause a lot of preening time lost. In some cases, birds can abandon nests because of parasites. It would appear that that has arisen from the interaction with lice. People, I just put that up because I loved it. Controlling lice, getting rid of the problems is important. I think I particularly like that one. It is so innocent, isn't it? The kid's probably pouring DDT on those chickens. And just to show they've been around a long time, that's a Viking louse found in Greenland. We've got our human partners. I've mentioned them earlier. I did talk about common names earlier, and just two more common names for you. That one, the head louse, has been called mechanized dandruff. This one, the other one, well, we call it crabs or pubic lice. The French call it papillon d'amour. Of these, of our lice, the only one which is a disease carrier is the head louse, is the body louse. The head louse does not carry disease. The body louse does. The crab louse does not. Kind of bizarrely, the head louse and the body louse are very, very close morphologically. They're very difficult to tell apart. There are ways which you can do it by measuring the claws, particularly. Gene flow between them tends to take about 20 years. Given that one can carry disease and the other one can't, it's probably a good idea to call them separate species. They feel like a political species because the control measures, if you just take the wrong one to test for insecticide resistance, you could be in serious problems. Looking at gene flow within an area, it would appear that head and body louse, there is quite significant gene flow. But really, the jury's still out on quite how separate they are. This picture just to show you how big a louse is. I do hold a small clinic if anybody has a particular... there was one member of staff now left the museum who I think we ought to have declared a nature reserve a number of times he came to see me. But I do assure you of complete confidentiality. One of the ways of control, of course, is grooming. Again, for those of you who have children, then behind the ears is a very good place to look. And it's, of course, very restful. As you know, it's just feeding through one's hair. Somebody feeding through your hair is extremely restful. And not uncommon, our closest relatives also do it. And in fact, our closest relatives, the basis of their social behaviour is perhaps mutual grooming. The reason, if you like, where social groups of chimpanzees and gorillas stay together is mutual grooming, to get rid of the lice. Which is why I would suggest that our social behaviour and our very civilization came about because we have lice. Thank you.
Starters for bringing to life a group that was just a name to me before the Zoraptera, and so much amazing, colourful behavioural accounts of the Embryoptera, and particularly the lice.
Of course.
So perhaps we'll take a few questions now, and could I just ask you to repeat the questions briefly for the recording? Thanks.
Meg.
Do chimpanzees have both head and body lice?
It would appear not, no. They have one species of louse which is found pretty well all over the body. The head and body louse with us, the body louse is found on actually clothing. It's more clothing louse than the body louse. It will be found just about clinging to body hairs, but it really likes clothes. The head louse is adapted to head hair and to eyebrows. The other species, the third species we have, the crab louse, is not found on the chimpanzee at all, With us, it's found on secondary body hair in the area which is most associated with the pubic region, but also chests and beards for those of us who have them, eyelashes, and for redheads on head hair because the hair is coarser and more widely separated. But no, chimpanzees only have the, if you like, the body louse pedicles.
Evolved with human beings?
The body louse almost certainly did evolve with human beings, yes. As soon as we started putting clothes on, then a louse moved into that niche. It also means that's why we don't have body louse so much today and why it's a big problem in warfare. They stay on the clothes, the eggs are laid on the clothes, and if you take the clothes off and put them aside for 7 days, the eggs will hatch and die because it's too cold. So in places where people cannot change their clothes, then that's where you get large numbers of the body louse, the clothing louse, and that's where you get plague and typhus and trench fever and relapsing fever. Lice, of course, in that way, are also used as a very spiritual tool. You'll recall that Thomas a Becket, after his martyrdom, his monks undressed him and found he was wearing a horsehair shirt which was seething and bubbling with lice. And they were amazed at his sanctity. Linda.
Chris, if a louse is perfectly comfortable on its host, why would it choose to move on to another one of the same species?
Why would a louse move to another host? Well, the reason a louse would move to another host, individual of the same species, is because it doesn't know it's doing so. It's because it's nice and warm and comfortable. It's wandering about, perhaps. And as I said before, when the temperature gradient breaks down, when two hosts are in physical contact, then it's just got a bigger area to walk around in.
Yeah. Do they move around a lot, though? Oh,
yes.
I imagine they spend quite a bit of time just hanging on.
No, the human head louse can spend its day on several different heads. It can move around quite a lot. There have been experiments done on mark-release recapture. Somebody did try that with a crab louse. They painted the crab lice with a green luminous dot and released them on a number of their more accommodating friends. And I'm told that seeing these little green dots move around in the habitat was something to behold. But they had a hell of a job actually getting them back again. It's just very difficult to go out in the street, approach total strangers and ask them if they've got crabs. And it's, can I give you another poem? And this is really a sociological treatment. Recondite research on the crab louse has established infections begin. When you're at home with your family, or when you're living in sin. Except in the case of the clergy, who accomplish remarkable feats and catch scabies and crabs from door handles and crabs and from towels and lavatory seats. there was a strong method tried of ridding people of louse by shaming them out of it. Cleanliness is next to godliness. And particularly with body lice and head lice, there was an association with dirt, particularly in Victorian times. And that was used as a tool to try and eradicate lice. Because it was believed they were associated with dirt, and that was a way of making people get clean and therefore lose their lice. And that carried on right up into last century. And indeed, up until about the 50s, having head lice was a criminal offence. And children could be taken away from school to a place of delousing and forcibly deloused. Vagrants taken into custody could be shaved to remove their body lice. And indeed, if you look at a museum publication on lice, we have that as a treatment for body lice, shaving the person entirely. I don't think we published that one now. Anything else?
We probably don't sell them, we just give the publication away. Spreading disinformation.
I hope not, no.
Well, if there aren't any more questions, I reckon it's time we had a drink and you can ask Chris for some more anecdotes.
Sorry, science, that was science.